this is Suzanne's, tape, Suzanne Lewis, in the office, that afternoon after the big test on the Scarlet Letter and the first showdown on Emerson. She had found this article, M-A-L-E, Molly, Mal, that helped a great deal. She just found it. She said she's surprised that I had referred him to it. I didn't refer him to any of the passages in those articles on the Emersonian reading of Scarlet Letter. I had given him enough to go by. I referred him to the articles that would broaden their view so they wouldn't be restricted to the Emersonian view or think that I was overdoing it. And this is Suzanne Lewis that afternoon after the test in the office, 2nd of May, 1969. And this is a new reel, Emerson 8. This is a new reel, Emerson 8, Channel 1 Right. A new reel, Emerson 8, Channel 1 Right. The beginning of the talk with Suzanne Lewis in the office, Friday afternoon, 2nd of May, 1969, after the big test on Scarlet Letter.
And Shirley and I were studying last night, and we were trying to figure out what in the world was going on with Dimmesdale, and neither of us were very sure. So I read the part about the divinity school about the farmers, because in here he says he's a true religionist. But then that doesn't fit what Emerson said about the formalists. I was just reading essays on it, the one he gave us and some others, and then the story itself, and I realized that his ability to speak, he had that ability before he ever sinned, so that wasn't what made him able to communicate with his listeners. I mean, that was part of him before he ever sinned.
Well, that chapter called
Interior, that I referred to,
Interior Heart,
yeah.
That's Dimmesdale before.
Yeah, and I didn't see that the first time I read it. But it's before he sinned. I mean, so that's part of him before ever he had the sin, which would even increase his sensibility.
Oh, well, I didn't realize that. I'll have to reread it.
At least that's the impression I had, that they were traits of his character, and it wasn't occasioned by the fact that he had transgressed.
Mm-hmm.
And then we, in the midst of popcorn and Coke and interruptions, I read the Mao article. And he talks about it in terms of vision and speak and the word. And art, and I know it just, this helped me a lot. I was surprised that you hadn't, you know, mentioned it in class. You know, if
I had
or one of the others.
Yeah, I hadn't taken it seriously. I must have misread it.
He's got a lot in to make it sound like the, you know, the word is for God, and like in the verse of John. But I can see where he's getting at that. He talks about them as the language being so important, and also the ability to see, the insight. He talks about Hester first on the scaffold, where she the first time, and says that from the vision she gets from the platform, from being up there, she sees her in perspective her past life and her life now and what's led up to it. It says it enables her to look inward and backward to her parents, her former home, her guilt, downward to the living realities of her present, the infant in the letter, and upward to the balcony where authority is seated. And then he starts from that point and discusses her.
Well, Hawthorne says that, doesn't he?
Yeah, about she takes flight, you know, escape, temporarily, and talks.
Oh, yes. Now that is a nice passage.
Scaffold of the pillory was a point of view that revealed to Hester Prynne the entire track along which she had been treading since her happy infancy.
The scaffold?
Yeah.
Well, but now, you see, really, really, I don't know how it would do that.
Well, as he describes, she's standing up there, and there are intervals where the scene right around her immediate shame fades, and she just, you know, like you wonder, how did I get here? And you just, your mind wanders along your path. At least hers did. And I don't think Mal doesn't say that's, you know, where the completion of the vision, but he goes through a long process for her.
Did he?
Mm-hmm. And talks about her, she sees it. It's about the recognition scene where she sees Chillingworth. And I really hadn't paid all that much attention to the Hester part on here.
Sure.
But he talks about her insight is so much better than the orthodoxy of the society, where she points out she is, gives them illumination as to the role Pearl plays. And where they tried to take the child away from her, she enlightens them as to the, you know, Pearl's purpose in life, and then she appeals to them still too.
Well, I never considered that scene. I mean, I just,
yeah. Well, he brings it in. He considers that as important as showing her function somewhat as being outside and having the inside. Is she that helps them understand the moral truth of her situation.
What is that in song?
I don't know.
Which comes first? Hester, the needle comes first?
Yeah.
And then this?
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Yes, that would be a development of it. Well, she's already isolated.
Yeah. But as I said, I didn't pay that much attention to the first part, just when he starts talking about Dimmesdale. And he says that Dimmesdale begins to gain a new perspective when he starts living with his guilt, in other words, when Chillingworth starts living with him, and he starts his internal questioning of himself after, you know, he doesn't confess to the sin when Hester's on the thing, and that he calls that his perspective, and that talks about in that chapter the leech where they talk about the window being open, the air was too chill, he was within the bounds of the he couldn't be out of the bounds of orthodoxy for too long because it's, you know, too rough for him. But he starts there, and whereas Hester can see more clearly than Dimmesdale at times, it's Dimmesdale that has the language to express what she sees. And
now
he goes
that?
In.
It's Dimmesdale that has the language. Yes. Well,
yeah.
How did that come about? Now, it's Dimmesdale that has the language to express what Hester sees.
Well,
does that mean the election?
Well, when she's talking to the governor, I think when he wants to take Pearl away from her, she says, "Speak thou for me," talking to Dimmesdale. "Explain to you, to these people in your words what I'm trying to say." And he does so, and they understand then after he's expressed it. And it talks. He says. Says the comprehension and communication of religious truth demands an intuitive fusion of language and vision. And then he goes in that section that we talked about the other day about the type of minister Dimmesdale was. It often suggested if Dimmesdale had not sinned, his native gifts would have placed him among the group of truly saintly fathers whose only fault was their failure to communicate the highest truth to the populace. And then he goes in that the quotation that about the tongue, the gift of Pentecost, the power of speech and addressing the human brotherhood.
That's the one in you.
That's why I missed. Zoom right on by. But he brings that out, and it says Dimmesdale burden keeps him on a level with the lowest so that he can still express these high truths in humble language. And anyway, he goes on, and I just thought it was real interesting. And then he goes on to the description of Hester. I guess would be another view of Hester. She has become a mannish vagrant, speculating in the gloomy labyrinth of the mind. It is a kind of dissipation in which her natural role as a woman has evaporated into space. The word outwardly imposed and outwardly worn has failed in its traditional rhetorical discipline. And when he talks about the word here, he means the letter. But it's Hester that leads Dimmesdale to his illumination. And when the interview in the forest, so that's where he brings in Emerson for the first time, says, where she offers a way of escape together. Never, not even in the exhortations of Emerson and Thoreau, has the vision of dawn, the promise of America, the dream of a second chance, found more deeply felt utterance than in her appeal, as she urges the time-drenched man to recover himself, to put on a new name and leave the ruin behind him, do anything save lie down and die. And this, to me, would be where Dimmesdale starts to see more clearly. I'm still, you know, not real clear about it, but it seems like this essay more than the others seems to.
Well, where does Dimmesdale see more clearly?
When he sees the promise of a new life, that this hope is held out to him, and he says the scales have dropped from his eyes, he has attained an Emersonian vision, that his old self, the tormented man, has been left behind, and he sees the possibility of a new view of himself, being able to take on a new life. Of course, later on, when he returns to the security of the books and his knowledge that he's had gained through the years, I guess evidently he realizes that this promise can't be filled and escaped.
Well, take right afterwards, after the fire scene, when he returns to town, the village, the town, and he talks to those parishioners.
He says...
Is that his new view?
No. It's a clouding. His old insight has been temporarily liberated, in other words, his old moral insight into it. He says, on the one hand, he is closer to the freedom of individual growth, less hampered by the principles and prejudices of a social system. On the other, he is, as the chapter title indicates, the minister in a maze, deeply involved in a moral wilderness. But he triumphs over this lack of, you know, he sees a new life, but also the vision is kind of clouded over by the things he wants to do, you know, to shock the institutions.
But that still is his new vision.
Yeah, I mean, he's...
And that's freedom from the old.
This is the man, like the nonconformity, the undisciplined nonconformity that would go off on wild tracks instead of being responsible to the man himself. In other words, he goes off, you know, on a tangent, or, you know, and, you know, he's made free, and he just goes wild with his freedom temporarily.
Yes. He just sports his nonconformity in a way.
Rather than...
Well, sort of reckless, really.
Yeah.
Well, do you suppose nonconformity, once one has a feeling of nonconformity, do you suppose it's always headed for a little while? And a person, an individual, ought to be allowed a little of that, a little leeway, a little grace, a little recklessness?
I think the person would do it anyway. I mean, because you just have this sense of freedom all of a sudden, and wham, you don't know what to do with it, so you do anything with it. And then gradually, I would suppose you realize that your freedom that you've gained yourself has to be used responsibly. That you can gain more from it, from your own self-discipline, than you can just, you know, going off at any angle you want to go. And that's what he says when he came back to the books, the intellectual resources of the study, that he, you know, comes back to the discipline. Evidently, when he's writing the election sermon,
he tears up the old one.
He tears up the old one and he writes the new one.
Well, when he writes the new one, he's not going backwards. He's going to that new vision.
Yeah, I know. He's going forward. Somewhere in that time, maybe when he talks to Chillingworth and faces him.
Oh, you're quoting him. He says he goes back.
I don't know when he.
Did he, Molly, say he goes back to his study?
Goes back to study, but then he says he's able to draw in the new vision with the rich utterances of the past.
Yes.
The election sermon. This is his new field. This is his true dawn.
Yes.
In other words, he's going in a new direction. He's not going back to what he was. He's still using
all
his vision.
All you've got to do is put to give it a word. That election sermon is just a just a Emersonian hymn. And the content of it. I have specified the content.
It's the language again.
Yes, but you also have the content. Are you supposed
about to? It's about the vocal organ and that like all other music, it breathes passion and pathos and a tongue native to the human heart.
Well, now, but he had that ability already.
Yeah.
Back in the tongue of flame.
Yeah. The idea I got from Hawthorne was the complaint of a human heart, sorrow-laden, perchance guilty, telling its secret to the great heart of mankind. Beseeching its sincere forgiveness at every moment in each accent and never in vain. It was this profound and continual undertone that gave the clergyman its most appropriate power.
Now, what was that? What was that?
That's the complaint of a human heart. Sorrow laden, chance guilty, telling its secret, whether of guilt and sorrow to the great heart of mankind.
All right, that's the old song.
Yeah.
That's not the
but
new
there's,
one.
There's somewhere, I can't remember where it was, where it talks about it. It being this rising in power, but I can't remember what it was.
Okay.
He drew near to close the spirit as a prophecy had come upon him, constraining him to its purpose. It was his mission to foretell a high and glorious destiny for the newly gathered people of the Lord. And up further it said the relationship between the deity and the communities of mankind, with a special reference to New England, which they were planting in the wilderness. And I guess it's the idea that just as he has entered a new life through his illumination, so this new world can go on to the new world can go on.
As in? The first paragraph of the American Scholar?
Oh, instead of taking the voices of Europe, now we can go on ourselves and make our own voices.
And the Divinity School of... you know what's wrong there? Read it out.
Oh. To go into solitude, a man needs to retire as much from his chamber as from society.
Now, this is the wrong one. I gave her this passage to read. And that's Emerson's whole new view that once Thoreau lived with from the very beginning of the address, Nature, or the essay, and I started at the wrong place, and then I got it straight.
Our age is retrospective. It builds the sepulchres of the fathers. It writes biographies, histories, and criticism. The foregoing generations beheld God and nature face to face, we through their eyes. Why should not we also enjoy an original relationship to the universe? Why should not we have a poetry and philosophy of insight and not of tradition, and a religion by relation to us and not the history of theirs?
That's it.
What else you say? Embosomed for a season in nature, whose floods of life stream around and through us and invite us by the powers they supply to action proportioned to nature, why should we grope among the dry bones of the past or put the living generation into masquerades out of its faded wardrobe?
That's right. Now take that along with the American Scholar.
Yeah.
And you get what Dimmesdale wound up on in the election sermon.
Yeah. A new world of our own.
Yeah.
We've built.
And we're not putting sepulchres over the bones of the past. How does he say it?
Bells of sepulchres of the fathers, writes biographies, histories, and criticism.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why should we not also enjoy an original relationship to the universe? Should we not have a poetry and philosophy of insight and not of tradition, and a religion by revelation to us, not the history of theirs?
Yes, not religion revelation to us and not a history of their revelation.
Yeah.
And that's what you get in the lecture sermon, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I never realized that. No, sir.
I wouldn't either if I hadn't read that essay, I don't think. Because it just seems to catch you better than any of the others. At least that part of it. Maybe just built in with what I already.
But I'm so fond of Randall Stewart.
Yeah. But his, I don't know, to me it just kind of paled in significance next to the other one. But I'm sure that it, I, you know, see that the two viewpoints conflicting it. Maybe Hoffman wouldn't, though I think it's kind of hard to tell which one ended up on top because he put so much, I guess, belief in both of them.
But that wind up with Dimmesdale is powerful. I've never felt that. You know, I've buzzed through it like you did. You know, I think people see what they want to see.
Okay.
And just cut out the rest.
Well, Dimmesdale, the way he's continually described makes him seem so, I mean, you just look, to me, makes this picture of an effeminate, you know, I don't know, with his mouth hanging open all the time, you know, and his hand over his heart. It just gives you the physical impression of weakness, and then it just seems to be reinforced, you know, the idea of a man who doesn't have the strength, the courage to admit his guilt and lets the woman do all the suffering. I mean, because that's the first impression I think a lot of people get.
I'm not bothered about that part of it, but I am about his falling apart.
Yeah.
Because on the other hand, he has such power. Wonder why. I think the only way I can figure it is that the legend and Hawthorne's use of the legend were so different.
Yeah, that the sin should be consuming, that it, you know, should. Unless perhaps it's the fact that Chillingworth, the sin itself, his guilt wouldn't do this to him, but Chillingworth keeps working on him. But I don't see how he could make such a comeback from, you know, just suddenly like that.
Well, I'm not bothered by the plot so much. But I think really that falling apart is part of the plot. Just like the scaffold, you know, that winding up with the scaffold, that's fiction. I'm not bothered by that. But that constant, like you say, that constant fictioning, all his nerves, his ribs sticking out. Yeah. Well, Suzanne, I tell you, now that's a long ways from where we started Monday, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, I think literature class in particular ought to remember where they start from.
Yeah, well, you have to cut through so much to see. Well, like you say, you misread it. And then again, of course, you know, you come in with your own opinions on what it means and all that kind of stuff. And you have to be able to see a different viewpoint and be able to open your own mind to see that viewpoint as well as your own. Then you have to put it all together.
Now, you can remember as far back as Monday. Talk about it the way you start out at Monday.
Well,
those terms I put on the board, I got from talking with you and Barbara.
I guess when I first, the way I read it, I was looking for the Emersonian element, the scholar, and I saw it in Hester, but the moral aspect to me, you know, I was trying to straighten out who was supposed to be right in it. That the fact that I consider Dimmesdale weak, I also consider that he gained strength by the end, that was an act of courage.
That's from confession.
Yeah. the confession was an act of courage. Yeah. In it.
But now our confession's got nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
You did see Hester in that light.
No, I saw her as the thing that struck me was the fact that she didn't feel that she had sinned.
What you felt was that she was doing penance.
Yeah, but she wasn't. She was doing it penance, but I didn't think that she really felt really repentant about the sin. She's just
but
doing
you,
it.
All you saw, Hester, was
that
she
was the sin and the repentance.
And she got repentance through public confession and living that way. Now you see how artificial that is?
Yeah.
Well, why would a person of your acumen ever entertain such an interpretation?
I don't know. Maybe that's the main interpretation that I've always heard from the Scarlet Letter.
Well, you don't just go along with the things that you've heard always. Now, here you are.
I used to start out with an impression of what I've heard. And if I try to, you know, see my own impression, too. But
you had no attitude of skepticism towards that. You seem to be confident and satisfied in that frame of mind.
Yeah.
You see a major piece of fiction resting in coming to terms with guilt through repentance.
Yeah. Well, you see, my upbringing would also lean toward that this is, would, you don't think so?
It's got nothing to do with your upbringing.
Well, I say my reading in the Bible, the idea of guilt and repentance and confession.
I'm not so sure that there's much of that in the Bible.
There's a lot of it in the church.
Institution.
Yeah.
Well,
I usually go into the book about half cocked if I've heard much about it. I was absolutely flabbergasted when I read Moby Dick. I really was. Because I thought it was going to be this massive novel about Captain Ahab and his search for revenge or whatever it was supposed to be. And the only thing that I could was what you mentioned about Ishmael's curiosity about the world outside of him. And that kind of helped me look at it from a different viewpoint rather than the biblical epic type thing. And then I realized it was more about whales than about Ahab. At least to me, that's composed more of anything else in the book. It was just about the whale.
And you have to feel with Ishmael such reverence for all those biological details. Mm-hmm. You just have to feel that. Can you feel it? It's hard to do, to project
well,
that life.
The idea that, you know, where the man, I think somebody asked him, why do you want to go to sea? And he says, well, I want to see things. And the guy says, well, look out on the sea. And that's all he saw, is just water. But Ishmael, I mean, there was the things under the water, the things above the water. It's just a whole world that the other man didn't even dream of.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you. I'm going to, the students are not up to this now. It's, and you know, if they don't see it, it annoys them. I'm going to have to shift the emphasis. I think I'll just have to rest it if I ever teach it again. I think I'll have to just sort of skirt Emerson and stay with Thoreau and some of the concrete things. And maybe do a little bit on this Emersonian pursuit. Take them out to the ranch someday and show them some of the things I've seen out there. one of the first ways that helped me enter this Emersonian world, it's a concrete world of the 19th century. We live in T.S. Eliot's world now. That's preserved by the academic, especially the graduate school. But you see, Ishmael's is all concrete. There's a whale, look, he's looking at it. And all that business of fighting this whale is really minor part of it.
He feels obliged to write something like that into the
thing
about
I got into some gates. I started making some gates, and I had never made a gate. These big gates, 12-foot gates. And I saw right off some of the problems. One is, you see, the nails split the timber, weaken it, and one bolt put on the stress places, well, you see, make an entirely different structure for you. And, you know, those props, those, I forget the words, the pieces, cross pieces. And I lived out on the North 40 there, and I had, of course, Latchway out past this millhopper, all the way out past there. It's still farming then. And I remember all those gates I looked at. And, you know, I got so I could, just in my sleep, I could see gates. And I finally came out with a particular sort of gate in mind. But it has a weakness. The one I finally got into will stand up. But you bust it if you push on it. And you see cattle sometimes push on it. So all it needs is just a little stake down there on the side where they'll push. But then they get in the way. Now that's what that did. I saw that they lived in the physical world, basically different from ours. It wasn't necessarily a world of people. Or if it was, the people were different. I don't know that we live with people.
I don't think we do. There are 40 girls on my dorm floor, and things would be very easy to, you know, meet them. But there's a group of six, and that's the group I'm with, and that's our group. And we have very little to do with any of the other groups, other than saying hello and how are you and stuff like that.
You know, the beautiful part, the beautiful case of the side of that is Ishmael in his cabin with his on the Pequot. You see, all those people come to life, the mates, the harpooners. And you know, it's a curious thing, Suzanne, how people would read that and they don't see those things. What Mel was interested in, that's what Mel was interested in.
Yeah.
It's an Emersonian document that a common man come to life. He doesn't come to life before that. Thoreau can't bring him to life. And then, you see, you've got Mark Twain. You got her. And you got that fool we read last time. You see, the, Mark Twain himself is his own character, you see, on the... He's such a spirit.
He tickled me to death. Sit there reading him. Jim, I start laughing. What's funny? I have to hear him read this about the coyote. I guess I've always appreciated people's sense of humor because anyway, just.
What about that huck along the river? The woman you see caught him when he.
Yeah.
Mrs. Fortis, what is her name?
I don't remember her name.
That's a gallery. Those people, they meet along the river. It's just a gallery, see? Such as I don't see anymore. I don't think we see anymore.
Yeah, and
now,
the family they stayed with, Aunt Sally?
Yeah. Now, you never thought you'd ever look at Huck as an Emersonian.
No. The only time I ever read Huckleberry Finn was when I was about 13.
Yeah.
And so far, I've escaped reading him in the classroom.
Yeah.
And from what I gather, it seemed like maybe it is the idea of, you know, river and manhood and life and all, but somehow it seemed like you'd lose a lot looking at it.
Yeah. Well, you see what he does, Suzanne, what he does, what it does, he brings to life what Emerson has a vision of. You see, and then in Huck and Tapsin and those people, you see, that is in the flesh.
Yeah, but they teach it as a, you know, the rite of initiation and in a mythological viewpoint. Seems to me a lot where they teach it a lot of times. I like not mythology as such, but of course the T.S. Eliot type thing. You know, that to me is interesting.
Yeah,
but
like
it's, I think sometimes it can be way overdrawn, and the same with psychology. Like this man makes very apt comment that something about Hawthorne. Oh, he's talking about Chillingworth. Fooling with Dimmesdale, you know, torturing, so to speak. And he says, he is one man playing with another hideously in a fashion that since has become a science. Hawthorne could not have foreseen the science, which, being a science, is doubtless no longer hideous. But the idea is a psychology that Hawthorne wouldn't look at a man playing with another man's soul as a science, which is how a psychologist would look at it. You know, if this is a fine clinical case of his psychological aspect.
Yeah, that's nice.
And
that's a nice article. I'm glad you found that. I hadn't found that.
It helped me. The terms he uses are funny, but I mean, I can see under what he's getting at.
Well, man has to do something. I'm gonna have to abandon this. It causes too much discomfort. I hate to abandon it. But I'll have to play down Emerson and play up Thoreau's use Thoreau's concrete. And I don't know what we'll talk about. But now you see what I'd like to do somehow or other. Go out there, some of these places. You see, I preserve this 19th century Emersonian world out there. I've got the Gates, for instance. And if I could kind of somehow get the labels and
it's the terms that are hard to name. To get down definitely what you're talking about when you use a certain word.
Yeah. But now, you see, you don't want to. You've got to explain it to people. I don't think it's worth having. Unless you take it up to the point where they can go from there.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to do it.
Well, I think maybe like I missed the part about the language thing. I mean, I probably would have gone on missing it. You know, as being just part of that one little section there. So I don't know. I think you need to maybe just give one or two keys that would help the person to work up.
Yeah. But you see the pressure is so great now.
Yeah.
The court system is so short.
You don't have time to work it out.
That nobody wants to, you know, sustain it over a week or two even. So unless it comes, I don't believe it. Now you watch and see. You can tell. You see when people are nervous. I walked out with Suzanne, and I said, well, what are you going to get into now? She said she had another literature course. I said, it's be shameful just to have to go off and leave all this fine material. It's in your mind now. Well, she said what she could do
would just go home and write out that test and get it a little clearer in her mind. This is the end of the visit with Suzanne Lewis in the office on Friday afternoon after the big test on Scarlet Letter on the 2nd of May, 1969. And this is the new reel, Emerson 8. And this is Channel 1 Right, 490. Jackie came out here on Tuesday or Thursday of that next week. See, I had been taping. Oh, she had come all the way from up past Melrose on the lake there where she lives. I'd sent word to her. I wanted this Professor Walp's little piece to use in all my groups. But she didn't send it to me. She brought it. And we talked and I taped. I had the tape out that day, somehow or other. And I transferred Fred's talk about Willie Welch at the ball game, his clear recollection of that scene, episode, a little scene. And I just discarded Jackie's. Then I kept wishing I had Jackie's down. And I just replayed it, and it has that sense of responsibility that I don't know whether to assume or not on the part of all these youngsters. So I put it with the Emerson group. She belongs there, you know. She is Roberta Salt's friend. Roberta bought her to class one day. Isn't that marvelous? And she's been trying to get Roberta out here. Roberta has the brightest face when she smiles of any child I ever saw. Now to start with, she lets me have this paper, first of all. That triggers all these dislocations that she talks about. And at the end, she gets to be more herself. And she and Ron both had too much schooling. He was still playing off down, working on his old boat down at the Keys, and she'd been playing off too from her school. And this is Channel 1 Right, about 500. More than that now, 520 really. And the beginning of the visit with Jackie about the week of May the 5th on Tuesday or Thursday. Channel 1 Right, around 520, the week of May the 5th.
That's
the real one or this copy?
This is that's the real speech.
Well,
and we'll let you have it.
Well, I'll get a copy.
Essay, lecture, and compare it with this and relate it to the students today. And this has meaning. This has meaning in our culture. It is just fabulous. It is. It's just wonderful.
Well, I'm anxious.
If you read this to them, I think you'd hear a pin drop. And here it is, the meat of it, too. After he goes through these items are wonderful, but then he sums up here. Oh, it's great. It just...
I'll just give it to Beverly or somebody.
To run zero, please?
And they can figure it's got the wrong shape.
See, too. This man was the editor of Punch. And he's retired, you know, and he was in Canada.
Crisis, you know, it works in the hands of the, well, let's say monopolies.
An elite.
Yeah.
Yeah, who do the decision on what to do in the crisis, yes.
And to the people in general, and especially to the poor man, you see, he suffers. So much of the attention of the authorities is given to the crisis, Vietnam, and all those things. That say nothing is given to conservation, so they can put oil wells in where they want to.
That's right.
So now that's...
All right.
We've been in a crisis, you see, for...
Not only that, but the...
generations. It's not just Vietnam.
No. For instance, one example is 42% of the agriculture that this country raises and used by this country is grown in California alone, and it has to be grown in the plains, the flatland of California. What has happened in California with the population explosion is you have had, corporations and money come in and buy up the farmland of the plains, the fertile soil, and plant housing developments, expansion of cities, and urbanization has crept out into the farmlands of California. And what has happened to the farmers? He has gone with the little money he's had, or else he's left agriculture altogether. And when he sold his farm, or else if he didn't leave it, he had to move into the slopes, the highlands, the hills, where it's more expensive for him to grow crops, the same kind of crops, but it's more expensive because of the various conditions, not only irrigation, but type of soil, and he doesn't get the amount per acre return yield. He doesn't get the yield in the hillsides, in the hills that he would get in the flatlands that has been taken up for urbanization, population growth.
That's
just one case.
That's going on everywhere.
Yes, and I'm only giving you one case. The other thing that I like to tell you is the amount of soil that is washed down the rivers in this country. It's one-third of the water of rivers that is washed down, washes one-third of the soil, topsoil with it. And we haven't done anything. Now we're only aware of it. We see what we've been doing. And pollution, water pollution, $100 million is just been allocated by the federal government to take care of the problem. This is just to take care of the problem after the fact, post facto, of water pollution, just water pollution. And like Disney, before he died, he had in the projected construction of this, he said one part of this complex will be the city of tomorrow. And he said he suggests that the United States, whether the federal government in joint with state governments, erects brand new urban centers, cities, away from the old ones. Because he says the cost would even be cheaper than to try to remodel the old urbanization center.
Is that right?
Yes, to put it like in Brasilia. They went out and constructed the whole new thing, which was fine, and served the transportation problem, which is, oh, that is something. The figures on the amount of cars coming out and available and the amount of highway space. Mm-hmm. You know, this just doesn't add up.
Yeah. And how much fun?
The planning, this is the point. The planning in all these areas comes after. You see, the crisis, as you say, the crisis is here. We're after it, and now we're starting to think about coping with it afterwards. You see? And this is, I don't know. Sometimes you just say to yourself, I feel like Hamlet.
Yeah.
You know, it's just that question you ask and don't know the answer, but you feel it.
You know, that like we were saying, where's the responsibility for it, for doing something with it? I don't feel too much responsibility. I don't find that sense of responsibility. Somehow don't. And I guess a class is not the place to find it, but you know that old feeling about Christianity. It's something public, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You proclaim it.
Yeah.
And
I know what you mean.
And I don't know. I've a long time. See, I felt like in class I can talk more sense than I can almost anywhere else.
Yeah.
So. I pushed that a little bit in the Emerson thing, in the American Scholar Address. That goes a horse down the hill, the pony. Frank Afrin. And it's a distinct section of the American Scholar, right after the 3 points about the education of the scholar. It's well, he just says the function of the scholar is to cheer and to guide and to lead men in facts amidst appearances and all. and it's his long subordination and neglect, but persisting, you see, in all those scholarly activities until the time comes, you see, when he does have a public function.
Mm-hmm.
To pass
mm-hmm.
on
mm-hmm.
these things that he has pursued.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't even get lip service to that. No. And
there's an awful lot of truth in it, because we must look at cultures besides us being Americans. For instance, at the university here, University of Florida, but New York University too, I remember. We used to boast, this was about 8 years ago, we boasted the largest foreign student enrollment of any university in the United States.
Oh, really?
Then. But I think after that, Berkeley, I think, got it, because California went up and jumped us after that. And you see, New York University is a private institution. But this is my point. These people, foreign students, come to the United States for a college education, for a university education, and many of them, the money to put them through this education is sometimes through our State Department, and many times it's all from their government. From their government of their country will pay for their education over here in whatever field. They get over here and they don't want to go back. And like Ronnie, because I discussed this with Ronnie, and he says, yeah, he says, why do they want to go back to that poverty and disease? And they don't have cars. They come here, they get a car. One of the first things they get is a car. They don't get a car over there. One of the first things they get is a secondhand used car, and they run around. Then they get a better car. They have TV. They don't have that in their country. He goes on with these luxuries of living, these comforts of living. And he says they don't want to go back with their responsibility to their people. So their people can be in South America. It can be in Haiti. It can be in India. And it can be in different islands there. And it can be in Africa, because there are many Africans. And it can be Egyptians. The Egyptians, they want to go back to Egypt where there's starvation and hunger.
But now, in connection with Emerson's public function as a scholar, you said a while ago you thought it was something that took for granted and you didn't even have to say it.
Yes, but I must qualify that statement. And I know this from having known students. I know students, and these are American students, mostly American students, although I know some students from France and Germany that I've known in New York, and they were this way too. They had this sense of responsibility to their community in this country, wherever it is, wherever they live. They are responsible people with compassion. They give of their knowledge, not only in a factual, beneficial way to their business and to their home life and to their friends in their community, but they give it in a compassionate way, which is, as a human being, they've expanded their compassion. Their compassion has expanded. There's no prejudice to help. Regardless of the people who have no education, who have no income, who are starving, they go right out and take out of their money and help them. They don't write it down as a tax exemption. They don't go to church, but they live that way. And that's why it didn't need defining, because it was so obvious. And these are the people I know. These are students I know. They believe in God. They live kindly. They don't judge people. That is one thing they don't do. They help them, and they contribute. And they do it magnanimously. They do it with a magnanimous. But I think the expansion of this compassion came with their education.
Do any of the institutions flourish anymore? Save. Think of the church, and especially the young people don't go very much, don't seem to.
Now, wait a minute,
much.
I have to ask you to define the word flourish. Where? Flourish within or flourish externally, overtly?
Overtly, externally.
Well, there's two ways of defining overtly and externally. Overtly in their relation with their peers, in their community, in their clubs, in class, in a job. The expression I have seen is compassionate. And if we define the meaning of Christian, like Christ would do, help everybody and anybody, they do this. This is the overt expression. Pardon me. But within the expression, does it flourish within the person? That I can't answer. Because I can only be subjective, and I can say it flourishes subjectively within me. How can you define it in words? And I know it does in my husband, but he does both. Now, he goes to church when he can, and he's treasurer for our Methodist church, and he runs the financial setup of that church and has for about 3 years. And he goes when he can, you know. And for a moral reason, won't go there because they're against integration de facto. And verbally they say that all people are created equal. And I've heard them say these old Bible quarters. And I get so mad, and I shouldn't maybe, but it's my indignation at the hypocrisy. And yet I must forgive them, Ronnie keeps saying. I must forgive them. And I says, but your forgiveness is giving them license to continue this hypocrisy. And here we have this, you know. And they said if a colored man was to walk into their church to a church service on Sunday, they'd get up and leave. And I wanted to know, I was teaching Sunday school, a high school kids, you know, and I had a good group and really swinging good group. And I just wanted it integrated. You know, that's why, so I quit.
Well, let me tell you, down here at McIntosh, you know, Maginopa, these little churches around here, they aren't attended. Their attendance is way down, and they don't have enough money to run the...
Now, let me tell you one thing that's happened to contribute to the lack of attendance, of the white attendance. When the United with the colored churches, the Methodist Church united with the colored Negro churches of Africa, African Negro, and the Baptists doing this, and the Presbyterian do this, and this has caused, in the past year or two, a drop. The old people said they're not going to contribute to them. And Ronnie heard this and told me. He heard this from these old-timers.
Well, it was dropping before that. I was thinking, I'm going to tell you what I thought. I don't know, you see. But it's some little trouble to get all darned out and get to take part in those things down there. It takes a considerable amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether...
Has it been emptied? Has the church and its function been emptied? By what? By TV?
Yeah.
Never discount the influence of TV.
Yeah.
And what it has done.
Yes.
Because even people who don't read are influenced by that.
Oh, yeah.
See?
Oh, yeah.
And I know, you know, you cannot say it is one factor responsible for this effect. You have to say there are many factors all working together to account for this effect.
Oh, yeah.
And this effect. And, of course, we observe it. We observe it and ask. We observe and ask. And,
well, you know, there's, thank you, let me tell you.
Has been put into the computer. And by the computer, they grade everything. The spoken language, reading material, whether it's magazines, it's just thrown into a computer. This is leaving out the element of the human personality, which I said is the obvious thing to us that we take for granted, the responsibility.
Well,
but that is not thrown into a computer. That's not cannot be machine oriented. And he's machine oriented.
This boy is little that way. They've got sort of an old sharecropper's attitude towards the world. And he objects to those things. But doesn't a man have any acumen left at all resist
that's
such things?
That's what cannot be
that?
Put. That's what cannot be put into the computer. That's what cannot be reduced to the machine. That cannot be reduced to the machine.
He didn't show any.
Well, I don't know.
He was reacting.
I think he was reacting.
He
was expected to react the way he was. Am I right? His peers reacted the way he was reacting.
Well, you kind of got me there, but in my view, he went along with the...
How old is he?
Well, he's a senior in college.
He's still reacting according to his peers. He's influenced by their peers.
Well, now, if I'm a peer, he's not reacting according to me.
No, I mean his age group. He's reacting according to
his
age group.
Yeah.
Right, his age group are going along with this concept, and he's going along with them, and he hasn't tested the concept.
No, he hasn't tested it. No, that's right.
That's right. Give him how many years to test it? Give him 10 years to test it. If he's going to, and that depends on conditions. Who can predict that he's going to test it? You see what I mean? With the way we're going.
That's it.
Well.
Let me tell you.
This I can't answer.
This is sort of pedantry. I go from that readability test to the prose that we hear on the campus in the lectures or that we read in the textbooks. And this is the way it comes out in my mind, that unless the prose is heavy enough and thick enough to sort of blunt our minds, we don't feel like we're getting anywhere.
Law, ethic, they call that business ethic, dog eat dog.
Yeah.
And this is what, oh, if I started to describe this ethic, dog eat dog, in New York business,
yeah,
it would make you nauseous. And I'm telling
this
you,
this is,
oh, it's something you want to close your eyes and say it isn't real when it is.
Yeah.
Do you know it?
Well, now, don't you know when they cut down on the price out in the country, don't they know that they are just cutting somebody out of a living? Now, where did you learn that out here in the country?
I heard it from people. This man, our neighbor, is retired. He's 70. Oh, God, I think he's 80 now. And he's from Jacksonville. He was a plumber in the union in Jacksonville. And, of course, he'll do his own plumbing in his own house. But Ronnie knows how to do our plumbing if we really get stuck. He can do plumbing, too. But he tell us about this. And people live in the outskirts of Jacksonville, see, that are friends of Mr. Pancoast. And he told us about this plumbing union, too, because he knows. Not all plumbers who are members of a union will do that, because if they know a man who is a plumber and who is not a member of the union and could be doing a rural plumbing job, if he's a good conscientious, and there are conscientious plumbers too as people,
yeah,
he will let the other fella do it. So you can't judge all of them by this one or two that are like that, because
yeah,
there always is an exception. And
well,
even though they're a minority, you know, few and far between, you must know. They'll ever be able to completely do away with the individual worker, the entrepreneur. He will always, they'll always be those enterprising individuals who must express their creative urge in being a single entrepreneur, even if he barely makes enough money to put food on the table. It's the satisfaction or the contribution of his effort. Let me tell you something. Ronnie and I met Ronnie down in the Keys, in Marathon, and he was running fishing boats, was the business he was running. He was managing these fishing boats that went out, you know, all day fishing and then went out all night fishing if they had enough people to go. And there were quite a few boats, you know, diesel engines and everything, and he would fix the marine engines, the diesel engines, you know, and he was all dirty and he had a Volkswagen stuff, and I met him. And he told me he had a college education. I said, "You're kidding, you don't have a college education." He says, "No, I'm not." And he takes me and shows me his letter from the dean, you know, he's all and everything, you know. I laughed, so then I told him I was from New York University. And I said, "I didn't finish my senior year." And he says, "Well, he had one course to go to finish his senior year. He got fed up with going to school." And he says, "I couldn't take it. I had to do something with my hands." So he says, this man, you know, millionaire, you know, owns these boats besides all other kind of businesses. He really runs from Miami and the Bahamas, too. And then he also had them in Belgium businesses. So for Mr. Brown, he was down there and he was running the businesses. And so we were engaged for about 6 months, because I was working at the museum. I was assistant to the curator at the museum.
Down there?
Yeah, down there. And it was really wonderful. Oh, it was fantastic, because all the books they had, out-of-print books, you know, from England, America, and everything, all the Smithsonian books, everything, you know, and I read these. And it was a beautiful reference library, fantastic reference library.
There's just a little more of Jackie on that week of May the 5th when she started with Professor Wolf of Harvard and talked about responsibility, and now she's down to Keys, how she met Ron. Both of them had enough of the universities. This is the end of Channel 1 Right.
David, he talked to me for 1 hour. He harangued, walked up and down, peripatetic. He says, "I hired you for life." I laughed. And he never cracked a smile. And I laughed like crazy. I thought that was the funniest thing I'd ever heard. He never cracked a smile, Mr. Craig. Poor man. God rest his soul. He died last December. And I just never thought he would. You know, he's robust, you know, and it was quite a shock.
That's the kind of guy. Good.
And they have fishing is their business. And sponging. Now, this is my girlfriend, Jeannie. See why I went?